Hello and welcome to the Two Time Labs podcast. And today on our show, I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming Judith Kohlberg. And Judith is a nothing short of a pioneer in the industry of organizing, in time management, in multiple areas. And she has a long and distinguished record of sort of pioneering the thinking around chronic disorganization. Judith, welcome to Two Time Labs podcast.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks so much.
Wonderful. And we're here in part to discuss your very latest book. Why don't you tell us the name of the book right up front so that people can start Googling it and maybe even order.
I like that. It's called Getting Organized in the Era of Endless. And the subtitle, which is really important, is What to Do When Information, Interruption, Work, and Stuff Are Endless, but Time Is Not.
I just went over the notes that you sent me, I think it was last year or earlier this year. And for the sake of our listenership, our listeners, Judith asked me to write the foreword for the book. So I saw in a very early version, and as I was reading it, just this morning, I was remembering, this is so true, and nobody's talking about the fact that we are just being buried by the amount of stuff that is flying at us every day. Isn't that true?
Well, I think that there's a lot of people writing about it from different perspectives, and other people have, you know, their responses to it, but I think in the organizational world, which is broad, you know, productivity and time management and getting organized, who doesn't contend with that? That the issue is more that we're not recognizing that we're in a very unique period, and yeah, that the old solutions, which have been, you know, pretty tried and true over the years since the 50s, have worked pretty well, but a lot of them are not working anymore.
That is so, so true. And but before we get into the solutions to today's problem,
yep,
how did you come to be? You know, I met you at the ICD conference, that's the Institute for Challenging Disorganization conference last year. And I'll be honest, I had no idea who you were.
I know.
It was only afterwards that I realized, oh my God, she's like everything.
You need to set your sights higher.
I was truly shocked that when you received some of the honors that they were giving out that night, the big
I was shocked
that,
too.
You look shocked.
I was shocked. It was quite an honor.
I had no idea that.
Well, here's the origins of it. Is that I started being a professional organizer many years ago, back in 1989. I started my business, and it doesn't take long before you encounter somebody early in your career who, you know, just doesn't fit the traditional mold. They're not going to respond to, you know, the usual, you know, pretty conventional organizing methods that you use, and then you've kind of walked away wondering, well, what was that? Why can't they do this? It's so obvious that you need to, you know, sort this way and organize that way and put things close for ease that way. And what's the problem here, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was really quite baffled by it. And so I, you know, had a series of these clients and felt quite like a failure, that I really hadn't helped them very much. It would be just sort of a Band-Aid, and I'd get them organized, and then 3 months later, everything had sort of be back where it was, right? Mm-hmm. So I went on a quest, basically, to other organizers, and even though it was a young organization, NAPO, at that time, and I brought photos of these clients who just didn't seem to respond to traditional organizing methods, and everybody said something different, like, you know, these can't help these people, they're not ready, or, you know, don't bother, it's just going to revert back again, or these people don't care about changing. And I was convinced that it was the organizer, not the person.
Whoa.
You know, that we just needed to work harder at finding something innovative, something different. You know, because these were very, you know, functional, intelligent people. There wasn't any, you know, obstacle in that direction which would keep them from being organizing and being organized and maintaining their organizing. So I think it was really up to us to find the methods and the techniques that would stick with them.
Mm. And so you're essentially a solo researcher at this point.
I guess, you know, all of my work is kind of anecdotal, although I have hundreds of clients, you know. So, you know, there are trends that you begin to see, but it isn't the kind of, you know, academic research or scientific method that you would use to come to conclusions in the way that you're starting to investigate time management with lots and lots of metrics and so forth. But I think that all the collective knowledge of people on the front lines working with folks counted for something.
It counted for the actual hands-on experience. And there was no one else doing that kind of research.
There was no one else saying, okay, here's what we tried. You know, let's talk about it together. Why what worked, and why what didn't work. You know, so it was really the collectivizing the discussion about it, which you might call, quote, the analysis, that I think was the breakthrough among organizers.
And did you survey other organizers in a systematic way, or did you just gather up what they said and work mostly with your clients to find out what would work?
We did a few things. We did some surveys. We did some interviewing. We gave presentations at all the NAPO conferences and all the NSGCD conferences, which is, for your listeners, NAPO is the National Association of Professional Organizers, and NSGCD is the National Study Group on Chronic Disorganization, which is the precursor to the Institute for Challenging Disorganization. So through these, you know, through our professional association conferences, we gave lots and lots of seminars and workshops and things like that, and got, you know, just overwhelming response from the audience of organizers about verifying that, you know, something was up with these folks. And, you know, and trying to reverse the engineering to figure out, you know, what we could say about new techniques and methods that people could use. And we came up with quite a few.
And I think you were the founder of the National Study Group on Chronic Disorganization.
I was, yes, indeed.
Yeah. I don't want to skip over that.
Somebody has to do it.
Not a small thing.
Yeah.
And were you there also for the transition to the IC? I know you were there, but were you the instigator in transitioning to the IC?
No, you know what? I was the director of the NSGCD for 7 years, and then I got out of the way, Francis, you know, and it was the best thing that could have happened to the NSGCD. It morphed into the ICD. They started, you know, a rigorous certification program and a rigorous education program, and they took this organization to places. First of all, I was not interested in, you know, participating in particularly in those kinds of ways. But they had so much more talent, to build an organization off of the foundation of the innovations that I put in place, and I'm very proud of doing that. But really, a lot of credit goes to a whole bunch of other people for building it into the future.
Well, there are those who pioneer, and then there are those who build.
Indeed.
Clearly, we're talking.
I pioneer, and then I get out of there. I let other people do the stuff, and then I start pulling the arrows out of my back.
but the truth is, as you're pulling out arrows, and as you're chasing out the door, the fact is you left behind a body of knowledge, an organization, and something that's self-sustaining. And today there exists knowledge, and there exists research, and there are multiple practitioners in the area. Am I being accurate?
No, it's just an extraordinary thing. I mean, there's influences on both sides. At NAPO, which is kind of the, you know, the more traditional organizers in the area of residential and business organizing, not to say that they're also not innovative, I'm not saying that too. But my goal was to teach every NAPO organizer about chronic disorganization. So that's something I'm very proud of, that having happened on the NAPO side. And then on the ICD side, yes, you're right. You know, we've attracted what we call affiliates and so forth and so on, who are in, you know, lots and lots of fields, like psychology and education and social work and gerontology and neurology. It's just been psychiatry. It's just been fascinating.
Wow. Well, you must be very, very, very proud. I'm just proud listening to you. And
well, you've kicked off one or two things yourself here.
But I now that I know who you are really. And I've come to appreciate so what you've created over time. It really is a groundbreaking sort of piece of work that you've put together, and you've established an industry.
Yeah.
And I really want our listeners to get what it takes to start with just an idea of there's something wrong that we're not addressing. You know, there's something in our clients' lives that's going unfulfilled that we're not adequately getting at, to the point where there is something that is substantial, that is addressing real-life concerns, that is causing families to function, that are causing professionals to live their lives effectively, that people, they don't necessarily know who you are, but they know that something is helping them, and that wouldn't have existed if you hadn't done your work. So
yeah, and I think it's an important takeaway to inspire people to, you know, have an idea and go and investigate it and talk to other people and risk being called crazy and, you know, and then, you know, chronicle what you've done and what you're doing, and so, you know, and write about it and teach about it so that you can get more feedback, because you really don't know what you know until you give it away.
Right. It's actually the perfect segue for where we're headed to next, because you saw the problem of the time, which was that of a chronic disorganization, and now you see a new problem.
I do. I would describe it this way. May I?
Sure.
Okay. That we live in an era of endless, and what I mean by that is that we're, and people know this intuitively, this is not a major breakthrough here, but that we're, you know, confronted by infinite information. There's really literally no end, you know, to the amount of information that can be found to, you know, answer a question or solve a problem or, you know, just address a curiosity. I mean, there's just no end to it, and that raises new organizing issues. Also, there are incessant interruptions and distractions, you know, things that we never thought that would, you know, come our way while we're trying to have a train of thought, right? Or mm-hmm. or try to get a task done, and all this stuff, you know, just keeps coming at us. I don't even have to go on to the list. I'm sure you know what it is. So there's that, and that's new. That's not a typical problem organizationally. And then there's, you know, this 24/7 ability to work. Now, of course, we don't work every day, you know, for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but we have the potential to be able to if we wanted.
Lucky us,
right? And so that's got a kind of an unending flavor to it. And then there's, you know, just kind of all this stuff. I mean, we're not only baby boomers who are about to have a tsunami of stuff fall into the world. But we're also, those baby boomers have inherited the vet generation, the generation before them, and then there's two generations after them, and the quality of their stuff is very different than disposable, biodegradable, you know, stuff that you and I mostly had. It's all electronic and digital and toxic. And so in some sense, that stuff is also endless, right? Because it doesn't degrade, it doesn't return to the earth. And so, you know, so there's all this unbounded stuff and this incessant interruption and these infinite information, and it butts up against the one thing that doesn't change, that isn't endless, which is time.
It sure does.
Yeah.
It sure does. You know, when I was a kid anyway, which seems long ago now, but maybe it wasn't all that long ago, but, you know, as I was growing up, the whole idea was that the more you got, the better.
Yeah.
That was the ethos. There was no such thing as too much. There was never enough. The background that I think we came from is that there is a scarcity of everything. So therefore, focus your attention on getting more of everything.
Yeah, I
and
think
maybe before you die, you'll actually have enough to feel okay about.
I think that's true. I think that we, you know, even in times of abundance, which there were many of, you know, since the end of World War II, there were many times of abundance, we still had this kind of waste not, want not ethic, which ran very deep into us, even if we weren't the children of the Depression. And so we had this kind of scarcity model, I think, of acquiring things. And even when we were prosperous, we had trouble giving stuff away or getting rid of stuff or whatever. You know, I think that that still persists. And I think that, you know, people are just now getting that, you know, that the materialism isn't a substitute, of course, for, you know, quality of life in other ways, in your family life, in your friends, in your social life, and so forth and so on, that it never has and never will replace, you know, that kind of quality.
You know, the fact is you don't have enough time to enjoy all of your stuff anymore.
No, you don't. No, in fact, a really classic example are these young people who download, you know, thousands of videos or music, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, but they don't know what they have, and they don't they don't have the time to enjoy it. And even if they organize it, right, even if they index it and they put, you know, this kind of jazz over here and rock over here and punk over here and they get to put it in categories and so forth, there's still this too much of it to enjoy sort of quality of a lot of things now that people are acquiring.
So there's not enough time to get through all of the stuff that we've accumulated. So maybe it then converts into some kind of regret, does it, at some point? Do we then say, I wish I had more time?
I don't know what we say yet. You know, I mean, I think that this is all just kind of playing out. I think people are losing a sense of favorites, you know, a sense of being discerning, of being discriminating, of being picky about what they love and what they own and what they choose to keep. I think they're kind of losing that because, after all, you know, you could really store things in the cloud without taking up a whole lot of space, right? It's endless. So there's really not the motivations that there were before to kind of cull things down. And so this mega decision-making quality that human beings have of deciding, of being the decider about their stuff, you know, it's all like, well, I might as well just keep it all. You know, I can. There's no reason why I can't. You know, so there's that whole area of what effect not being discerning and discriminating has on our decision-making skills in general. And that's something I'm very interested in exploring some more. But organizationally, it just makes for, you know, it's just a really kind of crazy, it's crazy out there.
So is that because we don't know what to do, or we just don't have the courage to confront the amount of stuff we are?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, there's a you know, this sense of overwhelm that can anybody you know can experience. You don't have to be disorganized or chronically disorganized to just open up your closet or, you know, go online and look at your digital library to get this huge feeling of overwhelm. I think that's very classic kind of emotional reaction to too much stuff. I think also that we, you know, there's this new fear of missing out, that if you don't gather it all, that somehow there's some pearl in there, some diamond in there, that you're going to miss. And young people in particular have this huge fear of missing out. They call it FOMO, F-O-M-O, fear of missing out.
Fear of missing out.
Yeah, so, you know, rather than, you know, curb their social media, for instance, you know, give that some structure, do a routine around checking their Facebook status and commenting on blogs and tweeting people, they just do it constantly because they have a fear of missing out on some kind of potential or opportunity or possibility, what I call in the book POP, potential opportunity or possibility, that's going to, you know, leave them behind the next person. So there's this very real dynamic out there. It's kind of a jungle out there.
Yeah, it sounds almost, I don't know if the word pathological is right, but it's something in the unconscious that is just like an energizer bunny, just has us keep going.
I think that's right. And it has, you know, different manifestations. Certainly it's accrues more to these young people than it does to people in my generation. I don't know how old you are, but I'm 60. And I'm, you know, less worried about fear of missing out. You know, it may just be a disorder of youth. I really don't know for sure, but you know, a lot of people even in their 30s and 40s who are adults and have responsibilities for family and jobs and paying mortgages and so forth and so on, that very young people don't have a little bit of this syndrome as well.
Well, you're saying it's more than just neglect. This is not just a habit that has produced a side effect. You're seeing that there is a deeper emotion, a deeper, darker emotion.
Well, you know, I think there's an interplay there between an emotion or a psychology around this and mm-hmm. the sociology or the society that mm-hmm. has laid the groundwork for this to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it's one thing or the other. There's certainly, you know, people operate in their society and in their culture, and they develop habits and preferences for how they do things, you know, because they live in a certain manner. And
right.
we're in this era of endless that has provoked or instigated or whatever, you know, things differently than how you and I did them.
Hmm. Well, it strikes me that someone who is a hoarder, for example, the sociology would kick in because, you know, their cousin would come over and say, "What the heck?"
Yeah.
You know, and then they'd clean the place up, you know, because someone, there'd be some feedback from their environment that this isn't acceptable.
Well, you know,
but digital stuff no one knows how much stuff you have.
Yeah, and it's, you know, because it's digital, it doesn't have the same cues physically, if mm-hmm. this is where you're going, that hoarding does, right? Mm-hmm. But there are people who are digital hoarders, and the signs of that are not physical or visual anymore, mm-hmm. but the signs of that are things like spending themselves into debt to buy these things, books uh-huh. and videos and movies and so forth, neglecting, you know, live family and friends and love for being on the internet, you know, displacing their leisure time into always being, you know, on the web. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of other signs of that there's a digital hoarder out there than the usual, you know, signs of visual. And so there's some people who are trying to be more vigilant about catching that too, because the effect is, I don't know if it's exactly the same, but, you know, it still disrupts family life, and it costs money, and it leaves people stressed, and it isolates folks, and it does a lot of the same things that, you know, cluttering your home up to the ceiling does.
Hmm. But not in our minds, though, is it?
Excuse me?
In our minds, it's not the same, right? Because I can pay, if I have to go buy storage, I have to pay for that. But, and everybody can see it, and my, you know, my wife would complain, why do you have to buy storage, why don't you just get rid of that stuff? But in my mind, the digital stuff doesn't seem like a problem.
Right, it doesn't seem like a problem. So, you know, and a problem isn't a problem unless, you know, there's some dysfunction from it. Like, you know, that it really becomes an obstacle in some way for some aspect of your quality of life, right?
Mm.
So I don't think that it's necessarily the same call all the time on it, but there are some dysfunctions of digital hoarding that do, you know, that we do need to pay some attention to, and that there are some signs and symbols of, and we just have to be smarter about it.
To self-police ourselves or to have other people be able to?
I don't know the answer to that. You know, I really don't know the answer to that. I worry about this thing we were talking about earlier about being the decider,
mm-hmm.
you know, learning, keeping this skill of mastering your environment,
mm-hmm.
Being the one who decides what stays here in my head or on my hard drive or in the cloud and mm-hmm. what doesn't. And
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, it doesn't keep me up at night, but I find it curious to think about a world in which people have lost that aptitude.
Because there's an imbalance here, is what I hear you saying.
Yeah.
There's endless stuff coming at us. We are ineffective at deciding what exactly has value and what hasn't, or what can be possibly enjoyed in this lifetime and what can't.
Right.
There's no feedback that tells, very little feedback, not until it gets to the point where it touches our pockets, and you can go for a long time before you spend a lot of money to have it be a problem.
Yeah.
So we have this behavior. There's no feedback available to us. So we just keep going and going and going and adding and adding and adding, not deciding, never deciding, never throwing away, never deleting.
Yeah, and just kind of being reactive to it. I mean, this deleting is a good expression of being the decider, right? But if you never delete, you never do that. So I don't know what the effects of that are on a person or a society. I just have no idea. But I do know that, you know, organizationally, it probably is a good idea to help your clients figure out some stopping points, you know, how to stop. Because another aspect of this endless information is that not only is the stuff endless, but it's a turn-on, you know. I mean, you really get turned on by this stuff. So not only is it abundant to the nth degree, but, you know, it really does something to you. It really lights up your brain. It really gives you that dopamine spurt, and that's really different than information gathering of the past.
Yeah. I think you're seeing that you can keep gathering without ever having to account for what you have gathered.
Yeah, and so a new organizing skill that I teach organizers constantly, that I always advocate for, is to, you know, put much more emphasis on pulling back, on assessing what you've gathered. You know, that we used to just help people information gather and organize it and access it and retrieve it, but now we have to give them, you know, that stand back and look at it and figure out, do you have enough of it? And because we have to have new criteria for done, for enough. And that's some of what I address in the book.
Oh boy, that sounds really, really hard.
Nah, not really. I don't know. Why does that sound hard? Tell me why that's
not in terms of once you realize you need to pull back, that part isn't hard. But it just runs contrary to the ethos of the day. You know, it's not about less. It's true.
But we used to have all kinds of stopping points, like facts, for instance, right? That could end an argument. But now there's counterfacts and counterarguments and all kinds of opinion and, you know, other points of view that are out there, and crowdsourcing, you know, every little bit of information. I mean, we used to have libraries that closed, right?
Right.
We used to have pieces of paper that had an end to it. All that stuff is gone. So
I grew up, we had an encyclopedia of, you know, it was like blue and white ones, and it was like 26 in the series.
That's it.
And that was it.
If it wasn't in the encyclopedia, it wasn't in your report.
Exactly.
I got it.
It didn't exist.
Yeah.
It was, things were easy.
So these stopping points become, you know, like a whole new thing. And I, you know, and people, time management specialists like yourself, I think, intuitively understand that people don't have any breaks anymore. And, you know, we need a lot of collaboration to figure out what are these new stopping points going to be in this world of endless?
What worries me is that people, by virtue of not pulling back, they are essentially saying yes to more than they can handle in a lifetime.
Yeah.
And more than they can handle healthily and still remain keep their sanity.
Yeah,
so they're essentially killing themselves. It's almost like, you know, overdosing on cholesterol or something. You're laying the seeds for your own dissatisfaction.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know, because there just might also be some new skills that these younger people have that you and I don't have that make them better equipped and prepared to handle this than you and I would have So, you know, there's a lot going on to figure out, you know, whether their brains are changing or their, you know, what they're being taught in school is changing about abundance and enough. I mean, I spoke to a high school English teacher who was saying that when he gives out essay assignments now, right, the kids go to Google, right, and they research the content, the subject matter, to death, and they throw it all into their essays. Mm-hmm. But they have no way of culling back the information that's most important, of just doing, you know, what's the substance that addresses the point of the essay. He gets, you know, essays that are like a million pages long and have all kinds of extraneous information in it. And so educators are going nuts too, but I think some teachers are figuring out how to teach new skills so that, you know, students are better prepared to express their ideas in writing and express their ideas in, you know, in debate and in verbal presentations, even though they, you know, have the temptation all around them to keep going and going and going and going, like your little bunny that you mentioned before. So I don't know. I mean, I don't want to...
I think there's... I would go out on a limb and say that the evidence... There's evidence that it's not being either taught or learned in the world of a teenager or a young adult who ends up trying to process information in a way that they don't consciously want to. I don't know how to say that, but it's kind of like somebody who's 20 years old driving on the highway. 20 years old driving on the highway, 75 miles an hour. They see that little light up on their iPhone that tells them that there's a message coming in. And they look over to the iPhone and they feel that temptation to pick it up and see who's that message from.
Yeah.
They pick up the device and they get into an accident.
Yeah.
And afterwards they say, "I wish I hadn't."
Yeah.
That's my
sort
of evidence that says that it's, and it's not that they necessarily, they would go back and say, you know, I was taught not to do that. Because they aren't being taught not to do that. There's just a law that may exist in some places that says don't do it. But they're not actually, they're not learning it and they're not being taught.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't have teens. Do you have teens?
No, no,
kids
I don't.
You're younger, right?
No, I don't have kids. No, I'm
just, yeah, me either.
Me and the wife.
So, you know, you and I are driving blind here, but...
We are.
but what I understand is that actually... as part of driver education, you know, there's a huge amount of emphasis put on not texting and driving. And parents who teach their kids how to drive, you know, are putting a special emphasis on that. I've invented, although I'm looking for a financial backer, a lens that goes on red lights that simply says don't text. You know, I mean, I think the message is getting out there. I get reports from emergency room doctors that, you know, that the kids are walking and texting and running into poles and falling down manholes, and they're not paying attention, you know. So, but I do think that there's no going backwards on these devices and all this temptation, which I think is a very interesting word instead of distraction and interruption. But I do think that the word will get out. There is a lot of transition that we're in. I think it has to, and I do believe that it will. Well, I don't think people are going to kill themselves as much as you think they are.
Well, here in Jamaica, we don't even have laws.
Huh?
There isn't even a law against texting and driving.
Well, there is in Georgia. I don't know if that's Jamaica, but here in Georgia there is.
Because we have, you know, we still have some of that wild behavior that you guys have given up some time ago.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe that's true. We have a lot of laws here. But, you know, when I give my talks now on the new interruption, this new temptation to follow every potential and opportunity and possibility, kids don't find that as disruptive as you and I used to, for one thing. But I always give the other side of the equation, which is how to stop pop, you know, to remind your clients of when it really is inappropriate or dangerous to be entertaining those things. I mean, you know, I tell my organizers to teach their young clients this all the time.
It reminds me of a strategic planning retreat I led about, well, let's just say earlier this year, so I don't identify my client. And during the retreat, the head of the company spent most of his time either out the room or on his computer checking email, or checking his BlackBerry, or chasing all
through. Slap those people, don't you?
I had to hold myself back from even a verbal slap because this is the client after all. but I thought of that, and I thought of, as we were talking, and I thought, you know, this person has an endless stream of information coming at them. They're obviously not managing it well. Several times we had to go back and repeat stuff that was said earlier, because every time someone, you know, someone who's important to our process leaves the process and then rejoins it an hour later,
they
force it to go back to the beginning.
Yeah.
Or at least to the point where they left off, because they are essential to whatever decision is being made. So the person acted as a break.
Right.
To the progress that the team was making. And, you know, they weren't my client with respect to anything time management or productivity related. It was only strategic planning.
Mm-hmm.
So I never said anything to them. But afterwards, I put in a clause in all of my contracts that says, no kidding, if you want the distraction discount.
Mm-hmm. And that's funny. I love the distraction.
Here are the rules.
Oh, that
during
is
the
so
retreat,
funny.
There are no devices, no busy work.
Yeah.
You're here to do only the work of the retreat. During the breaks, you're allowed to access whatever. Mm. So I've written that into my last few contracts and try to get the point across. I'm also not willing to do the extra work it takes to bring anyone up to speed because they're too busy to be doing this activity.
Yeah, no, I get it. No, I get it. I mean, I think two things that I've done to cope or adapt to that kind of behavior. One is I always encourage my clients to develop a family technology policy.
Oh, tell us.
You know, which is, you know, no devices within 10 feet of water, right? Whether that's an ocean or a bathtub or a sink or a toilet. Or, you know, just don't be on the damn things where they can get wet. You know, practical things like you're not allowed to sleep with your laptop. You know, all screens will be shut down at 9:30 if you're 9 years old. You know, just develop these. Nobody in this family you will never see the adults in this family, you know, drive and text at the same time because the adults have to model this stuff, you know, for the young people. So, you know, is this a legitimate organizing kind of area? You know me, my boundaries are a little fluid. And I think a new challenge for organizers is to help a family get a grip. And a family technology policy is my counterpart to your corporate clause. You follow me?
I've never even heard of anything like that.
Oh, yeah. No, it's in the book,
Mom. Very disturbing.
Read the book, Mom.
I know. I've never heard of it in the sense that in the popular press, I mean.
No, I know.
It's not like people are talking about the need for this, even though everyone is on the receiving end of it.
Yeah.
And they're
complaining. No texting in front of grandma because it drives her crazy. You know, I mean, you know, there's stuff we know. You just have to embody it into a little policy that the whole family will sign off on. I think it's a great idea.
I think it's fabulous. What other techniques should people be employing to deal with this?
You mentioned this point about leaving off, you know, that you interrupt yourself, and then you have to get back to where you left off. And I know that you've done some work on, you know, the effect of that, of, like, leaving your work and then coming back to it, and how, you know, two other things in the meanwhile have come into your environment that have that are obstacles for you to return to the original task that you got distracted from. It's called recovery time.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you know a little bit about this. So I've been teaching my I have both, some of my clients are professional organizers because I'm mentoring them, and some of my clients are the end users, which are the, you know, people I'm getting organized. So when I say I teach my clients, it's both levels.
Right.
So I teach them, you know, about recovery time and the scientific effect, the proof about recovery time. And so we put a little bit more effort than I used to put in 10 years ago on how to remember where you left off. You know, that's an organizing issue now.
It sure is.
Sure.
It's a big problem
for
in my case, because I focus on the workplace. Huge problem in the workplace.
Yeah, so we're developing some techniques for that. You know, and again, there's a way in which you and I could have another, you know, half-hour discussion on tips and methods and techniques, and it can devolve, you know, downward into these things. I mean, I think that their practical answers and solutions are incredibly important, and I'm not much for just philosophy, but I do think that it's really refreshing to be able to talk to somebody like you, who is also up there, who is also, you know, and I really wanted to take a minute to compliment you on this as a colleague, to these engaging issues, you know, more philosophically and also practically. And so I really want to thank you for that.
Well, thanks, Judith. My wife would complain and say, yeah, because he's all taking out the garbage. She's very good at bringing me back down from...
Oh, I bet. I bet having a wife is very humbling, no doubt.
Why is it that you can't take out the garbage?
Well, you know, it's very funny that you should mention taking out the garbage, because that's another new technique. Do you want to hear it?
Tell me.
Okay, so we knew what taking out the garbage was. My brothers all took out the garbage when we were young people. That was their chore in the family, right?
Yes.
I think that we need a new way of taking out the garbage in every family, which is, you know, what are you going to do when a device, you want to sell the device, you want to upgrade, who's going to take responsibility for, you know, recycling that or selling that or donating that or whatever, taking out that garbage. Who's going to be the device captain in the family, the person who does the syncing and does the charging and, you know, labels the cords, and, you know, that's a whole new, there are new chores out there than there were before. And part of what happens, I think a lot of families complain that the kids don't have chores anymore. But the problem is that the chores are not adapted to the world that these kids live in. And so they're bored with those chores, you know. And that's okay. Chores are supposed to be boring. They're not supposed to be stimulating. That's one of the reasons why they're called chores. But I do think they need an upgrade, to use your language.
Well, for example, you could assign a child the task of ensuring that all the backups happen faithfully.
Easily. Teens love that stuff.
And that the quality of the backups improves over time.
Yeah, exactly.
And gets cheaper.
Yeah, that would be
their
job.
A huge job.
It's a huge job. There's lots to do in the world of technology and devices. Lots and lots of chores and routines and jobs that young people could be doing if their parents would think a little bit more creatively.
And I also heard of a I don't know if this is a chore, a job, a profession. I don't know what it is, but when you die, who the heck? I have a friend on, an ex-friend, he's deceased. A deceased friend on Facebook.
Yeah, that's scary, isn't it? It's so scary.
On Facebook.
I know.
Birthday updates.
I know. It actually has a name. You ready?
It has a name.
Yeah, it's called Information Afterlife.
Information.
It's really something, and it's actually a rather lucrative new area in the organizing world where, you know, somebody's got to figure out a kind of a digital estate plan. Because we have tons of assets that are digital. You know, you could rattle them off. We have email, and we have avatars, and we have websites, and we have passwords, and we have domain names, and holy crap.
I can't afford to die right now because I have no one. I have no one. My wife would be not interested in managing all of the stuff that the loose ends I would leave if I were to pass away. And
luckily for her, there's a chapter in the book called Information Afterlife, Creating a Digital Estate Plan. And, you know, so that might help.
I think that would. I think that would. That'd be exactly what she'd need.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone in Jamaica who's an expert. You don't have to be in Jamaica for that. You could be anywhere.
No, but you do have to be good to run it by an accountant and to run it by an attorney. you know, because this is like part of your will. It's like part of your final documents to have a digital estate plan. So, you know, it's going to have all your social media account numbers on it and your passwords. And just think, I don't know if you do this, Francis, but I've got like all these automatic withdrawals that come out of my checking account to pay bills, right? And I have
you can't afford to pass away either.
You can't afford to pass away. All this stuff is going to go on. Who's going to stop it?
You're not
going
to stop.
Very scary. So anyway, that's a new organizing, specialty that I'm promoting.
Fascinating. You know, I know our listeners are thinking and wondering. You know, how do I...
You think we're nuts. That's what they think.
No, because everyone has... I hope not. But we are nuts. But they're wondering also, I have digital assets that I'm not managing. You know, I don't have a plan for what to do with them after I'm passed away.
Yeah.
I have a hard drive with stuff on it that maybe I'd like to delete some of it before anybody gets their eyes on it.
Ooh.
I probably have all sorts of
yeah.
You know, there's a progression of things that are some which are sensitive, some of which are.
Well, let me for the benefit of do you sell these podcasts afterwards as product? The podcast?
No, I don't.
Oh,
no,
you don't.
They're available on the internet.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, then let me just mention a few more of them so that, you know, we can jog people's thinking about this. Okay. So you've got the obvious ones like email, social media accounts, but some people also have digital collections. You know, like I have my whole family genealogy research is in the cloud, you know?
I have that too.
All right. So there you go. Yeah. You've got online subscriptions. You've got frequent flyer miles. Maybe obviously you've got blogs.
Yeah.
Your websites. And so, and it could be anywhere. It could be on your hard drive, or it can be, you know, on a flash drive external. It could be on CDs. It could be on the web. It could be in the cloud. I mean, you know, anyway, I just wanted to kind of...
When I buy an Amazon book, who owns that after I passed away?
Amazon still owns the book.
They own the book? What
no,
am I doing? Renting
kidding.
It?
I'm only kidding.
It's probably true.
No, they own they own the stuff that's in their catalog. They own their inventory. But once you buy a copy, that's yours.
But when I buy a digital copy, I'm
it's yours. And then there's the author who owns the copyright. The rights to the copy inside. This is a very elaborate world we live in. I mean, you know, I do some publishing.
Yes.
And all of this can get very crazy, you know, with ebooks and things that are digitized and so forth and so on, probably a whole other podcast.
But when I pass away,
does
my wife, can she inherit my books?
Can she inherit your
Kindle books?
Oh, your Kindle books. I have no idea.
I bet you she can't.
I bet you better go talk to an attorney. This is what I'm saying. It's like, these are assets.
Right.
If you think of them as digital assets,
yes,
like you do everything else that's an asset that you're going to bequeath to people, you know, in your will, you know, then you start to get a sense of what a gap this is.
It takes me to this point, which is that we in the age of endless, we respond by making endless time demands.
Huh?
We aren't capping either in this life or the next, because after we're gone, my friend, for example, who passed away, so he didn't know he was doing this, but he's left a task for someone to do.
Oh, God, you're kidding.
He had to, because somebody had to clean up his Facebook account.
Uh-huh.
Now, that person doesn't know that they have to do it yet.
Uh-huh. I see.
His account is sitting out there in perpetuity.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe one of, actually it's awful because his spouse also passed away.
Oof.
So one of his kids would have to go in and then, you know, do the dirty work, so to speak.
Yeah.
But what it strikes me that we're doing is we're in response to all this information, and because we're not pulling back, we don't have that skill, we are creating time demands, which is my language for just tasks completed in the future.
Uh-huh.
We're creating them without any regard for A, whether we can do them, or B, who's going to be doing them. It's almost like we're not being responsible.
It's almost like that. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that again, there's this piece about whether the norms of society and culture are changing so that that's quite okay, and it isn't, you know, the irresponsibleness that you and I grew up with, that, yeah. that those, you know, norms are evolving too to be appropriate for the world that we live in and the world of the future.
Yeah.
But currently, you know, I think that that's probably that's a pretty good call. I would agree with most of what you said.
Yeah, I wonder if I would say we're being reckless.
I'm not going to go down on tape. I'm not going to go down on tape. You know, I'm just so. It's such an amazing world, Francis. You know, there's so much good about it. There's, you know, doctors not only without borders, but, you know, who can consult in a little hut in Africa while they're doing a surgery on somebody with the, you know, the chief of surgery in England without regard to time or language or, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I just hesitate to be so down on this world. There's just so much good about it that's just totally mind-blowing.
It's sure, but isn't that the point of the Age of Endless? There's so much good coming out.
Yes.
That if we don't curate all of that goodness out there.
Oh, I like that word.
And manage it in a way that is, let's say, responsible.
Yeah.
If we don't manage it responsibly, there will be a feedback loop.
Yeah.
There will be a day of reckoning. It's just that, for example, for my friend, his Facebook profile goes on forever. So the day of reckoning was his. But someone will reckon with, my goodness, his birthday keeps coming up. I guess all of us do who knew him, because his birthday comes up. It says, send him happy birthday every time it comes
I
up.
I know, it's crazy.
God.
I know. I have a client who has a father who has just rigged his Facebook account to send a birthday card every year to his grandchildren, whether he's dead or alive.
Ooh.
Anyway.
Do that?
All right. Well, you know, but here's the thing is that, you know, it's fabulous that there's so much information. It's wonderful that we don't have to stop working when we're in the mood or on a tear or, you know, in the flow or whatever. It's great that we have enough stuff to make us happy and then some. It's wonderful that, you know, we have potential and opportunity and possibility at every turn. But, yeah, it's just complicated. There's a downside and there's excesses to everything.
Yeah, and with I guess the point you're making is that with greater awareness, with understanding, we'll lessen the downsides. We'll have all the benefits.
Yeah, I do think it's a question of education and awareness, yeah.
It might not take much for us to alleviate that. It doesn't take much for us to say, I don't know for sure, but it doesn't take much for us to say, if I don't log into my Facebook account for 6 months, then send me a note, and if I don't respond to the note, then delete it.
Well, I wouldn't say 6 months. That might be a bit of a stretch for some people. But yes, but putting some, you know, some effort into the criterias and the parameters and the rules and the, you know, all of that, boundaries, that kind of stuff, I think is well worth it for people.
Mm, and also for the people who are around us, because it's not just about our own frame of mind. It's also what we do in our community and in our families. And maybe that's the part that we in our sort of our love for more goodness, we don't appreciate that, and say keep in continually saying yes, that it actually has an effect on ourselves, our life, our society. And it's something that we actually, if we have to think about it, we don't want. But today, we don't really see. So it just kind of keeps on going.
Yeah. Well put.
Well, that's probably a good way to close out our...
Are you depressed? I don't want to leave you depressed.
Get ourselves
now.
No. Okay. Far from it. You know, it actually... Because we're seeing... This is about sort of being really sensitive to... Like, for example, I come back to my friend's Facebook profile.
Yes.
You know, being sensitive to that and thinking, not just seeing it and shaking my head and saying, somebody needs to clean that up, and then moving on. But it's then asking the next question, which is, what do I have in place to take care of something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't have anything. I haven't even thought of it really until we talked today. So it's picking up on these sensitive, being sensitive to sort of these early indicators
mm-hmm.
that the age of endless has an effect that reaches not just our lives, but the lives of people around us. And even after we're gone, it still has an effect.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, and, you know, like kids falling into manholes, you know, that's an early indicator. It's wrong.
Right. While they're texting.
Not a good indication.
That's not a good indication, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, but somebody's already inventing, maybe it's me, a cell phone that beams out a kind of a little radar radius around a person that alerts them that they're about to bung into something. You never know.
Those are exactly the kinds of things that we actually need.
I think so.
Can keep on enjoying it without experiencing any of the downside, because we're creating this downside as we enjoy as we enjoy all of this information and all this wonderful stuff. We're creating a downside that's only just trickling into view.
Right, but devices will never replace people, and when they do, I'm out of here. You know what I'm saying? I'm just out of here.
I don't know.
I mean, there's a role for robotics. There's a role for robotics. I'm not talking about robotics. I'm just, you know, I'm talking about, you know, making love to a live person real time. That would be nice. You know, doing real time dating, you know, all the things that make for, you know, the development of a human being that's compassionate and responsive, you know, to other people in their environment. That's not something we want to lose.
Yeah, okay. No, you're scaring me completely.
Okay. Time to go.
So, once again, Judith, I just want to say it's been a pleasure having you on the show. And how can our listeners find out about your book and the work that you do?
Well, the book is called Getting Organized in the Era of Endless, and the last name is spelled K-O-L-B-E-R-G, and it's available at www.squallpress.net, and it's also available on Amazon, and folks can reach me at my website, which is www.squallpress, which is the product site, or it's www.fileheads.net, which is the service site.
Excellent. And do you have another book coming out anytime soon?
No, please, God. This one just killed me. I've got to wait to do another one. You know the feeling, I'm sure.
I sure do. Well, Judith, once again, thanks for coming on the Two Time Labs podcast.
Okay.
And tune in next time for another episode from Two Time Labs podcast. We'll be back in the next couple of weeks. And this is Francis Wade signing out. Take care and thanks for joining us. All the best.